You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm back with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
We're back for a second week. We've made it to week two in the season.
50 to go.
Oh.
Confident. Oh, I see this last week.
We're not really out of the neutralised zone yet, are we? I'm faffing about still, you know.
Lionel's had a crash in the neutralised zone. It's like Froome in the 2013 Tour de France.
I've left stuff in the team car that I need. It's all a shambles. But, you know, when the race is really on later in the season, we'll be pinging.
Once Lionel starts going, it's very difficult to stop him.
What, in the sense that once I'm up to speed, I've got momentum and
weight behind
me? It
can be interpreted in any number of ways, that, Lionel.
Before we start, you may notice that Richard forgot to ask the usual question, where are we, Lionel? I don't think he took my joke about charging a royalty for each use of the phrase seriously. I think he just forgot. Anyway, we met up at a cafe inside St Pancras Station in London. So if you hear a hiss of air every now and then and wonder what it is, it's not the sound of the world's largest coffee machine or of Richard letting out a huge sigh of exasperation at something I've said. It's just the noise of a train pulling away from the station. Now that's clear, let's get on with the show.
I hope you've brought your news roundup with you, though.
I have. Very early days in the season, isn't it? The Tour Down Under has concluded the first World Tour race of the season. And Richard, you suggested that Richie Porte might bluff his way to victory on Willunga Hill. Well, he did. Fifth year in a row that he's won on the Adelaide Alpe d'Huez.
Do I detect a slightly different pronunciation there? Willunga.
Yeah, your hip surgeon on Twitter pointed out that it's Willunga Hill, not Willunga.
Thank you for that, Mr. Banks.
Willunga Hill, mate.
Yeah. So I'm just going to call it the Adelaide Alpe d'Huez, just for ease, I think. Anyway, Richie Porte won there for the fifth year in a row, back from his crash at the Tour de France on the descent on the way into Chambéry last year. Daryl Impey won overall, though, beating Richie Porte by the narrowest of margins, and that's given Mitchelton Scott a big win on home soil to start their season.
Well done, Lionel.
Ping.
Well done. I thought you said you were a shambles at one, but that's
I got that right.
That's a good one.
Yeah, well done, Orica. Andre Greipel won the first and last stages. He kind of won the sprint honours, but Caleb Ewan, Elia Viviani and Peter Sagan also won one each. Another sprinter who is already off the mark, Fernando Gaviria. He won the opening stage of the Vuelta a San Juan in Argentina. Another race that's going on at the moment is the Tropical Amisa Bongo, and a bit of a blast from the past here because one of the stages was won by Rinaldo Nocentini. You probably remember he wore the yellow jersey for a week in 2009 at the Tour de France. It's not quite in Davide Rebellin levels of the scale of longevity, but Nocentini is 40 years old and he's riding for the Portuguese Sporting Tavira team. So I just thought that was worth a mention. Somebody people may well remember from the old AG2R days.
Fantastic. What a fantastic kit they've got as well.
Have they?
It's the spin-off of Sporting Club, which a lot of people erroneously refer to as Sporting Lisbon, one of the two main football clubs in Lisbon. Have I already incurred a penalty for mentioning football? Is that the first one of the new year? We discussed sanctions in the winter. I can't remember what they were.
Is it green and white hoops then? Like Celtic?
Yeah, it's hoops.
Oh, lovely.
It's a nice kit.
Lovely.
I had a Sabutio team with Sporting Lisbon.
There was a time not too long ago when in Portuguese cycling there was a Benfica team, also played in, you know, more or less the same kit as the football team, and Boavista as well, Czech, wearing black and white Czechs. And I think there might have been there is a Porto team. There's a W52 FC Porto team. They also play in this more or less exactly the same kit as Porto football team. Anyway, sorry, Lionel. Probably alienated a lot of people.
Far too much football there. It's the winter anyway, really, isn't it? Road racing is just wrong in January. I can hear the Twitter comments and emails coming in already, but it's cyclocross and track season. And in the cyclocross, Mathieu van der Poel and Katie Compton won the men's and women's races at the final World Cup of the season in Nîmes in eastern France. Sorry, not the final World Cup of the season. It's a penultimate World Cup of the season because the last round is in Hoogeheide at the weekend. Concluded in one sense because van der Poel, with his sixth win of this season, has already clinched takes the World Cup title. Then it's all off to the World Championships in Valkenburg, where the Cycling Podcast will be. We'll be doing the first episode of the Cyclocross Podcast. That will be out early next week. We're doing a little run of four episodes as a bit of a trial to see whether there's an appetite out there for cyclocross coverage. And if there is, we may well try and expand and add that to our repertoire next winter. So listen out to the first episode of the Cyclocross Podcast.
What next? Where is this going to end? Is indoor cycling is the logical next step, isn't it?
Barney, you should mention that. We're not doing the indoor cycling podcast. The World Cup track season is at an end. The final round was in Minsk, Belarus. And the big story from there was that Team KGF, the small British squad, continued to make waves. They won the team pursuit with a time of 3:56.015. And Daniel, as a keen student of indoor cycling and all the times which go down to, you know, decimal points, that time was good enough, would have been good enough to win them the world title when the Worlds were held on that track in Minsk in 2013. So a really impressive performance by Team KGF there. Their rider Charlie Tanfield also won the individual pursuit. I said that's the last track World Cup of the season, which it is. The World Championships on the track are in Apeldoorn in the Netherlands, and they start on February the 28th. We can't be there, can we, Richard? Because that is the same day as the Grand Départ of the Cycling Podcast Grand Tour of Britain. We will be live at the Lowry Theatre in Salford that night.
Yeah, so I was just thinking about Team KGF. Did they not burn £1 million on a beach at some point? In the
oh, obscure reference, 90s reference.
I'm going to plug our forthcoming Grand Tour of parts of Britain, but not other parts of Britain. We are going to tour those other parts of Britain later in the year. We've already actually made some very tentative plans on that, so stay tuned for that. But more immediately, Wednesday the 28th of February, we will be in Salford at the Keys Theatre. That's in the Lowry. On the following night, Thursday the 1st of March, at the Signet Library in Edinburgh. On Friday the 2nd of March, will be the Oranmore in Glasgow. Following week, Wednesday the 7th of March, at the Nottingham Arts Theatre, Nottingham. Thursday the 8th of March, the Round Chapel in Hackney, London. Friday the 9th of March, the Carriage Works in Leeds. And on Saturday the 10th of March, the Showrooms in Sheffield. Go to thecyclingpodcast.com, live events. There's a on the menu, live events will take you to the page for the tour and the book, and you can get your tickets from there.
Tickets are selling well, aren't they? We'd love full houses everywhere we go, so do get your tickets if you live in and around one of those towns or cities. The book, A Journey Through the Cycling Year, this tour is basically to help promote and launch our first book, and there will be the option to buy a ticket plus book, and you can get a bit of a discount on the book price. While we're just talking about events that we're doing, I should also mention that we're returning to the Chalet La Giétaz in the French Alps. A couple of years ago now, Rich, we stayed there for a couple of nights and we did a soiree for some people who had arranged to come along. And if you would like to join us on Tuesday, July the 17th, which is the night after the stage to Le Grand Bornand, go to www.chalet-la-giétaz.com, and Giétaz is G-I-E-T-T-A-Z, and you can find out details there and book a place to come and see us during the tour. Plenty of plugging there. Daniel, I felt that I'd missed something from the news roundup, some news from Italy that you might be able to fill us in on.
Yeah, on Saturday, Lionel, we finally learned which teams had earned a wild card for the 2018 Giro d'Italia. There were a couple of delays on the announcement, but the news finally came through on Saturday. So four teams, one big surprise, I would say. So Bardiani, I would say, with a big surprise. Yala Israel Cycling Academy, we expected them to get one by virtue of the fact mainly that the Giro is starting in Israel, or should start in Israel, all things being equal. And then Willia Selitalia, so that's the peacock of San Diego, Filippo Pozzato's team. Big year for him, big year for the podcast by virtue of the fact it's a big year for, you know, one of our best friends, because it's his last season in the Pro Peloton. It should be the fourth team that was selected and has earned a wild card is Gianni Savio's team, another friend of the podcast. So Androni Giocattoli, they won the Coppa Italia last year, so we're automatically selected effectively. Yeah, as I said, big surprise that Bardiani got one because Pirazzi and Ruffoni were kicked out of the Giro on the eve of the race last year. That didn't look good for them. It didn't look good for the race organisation. It was all very embarrassing. Bardiani, then the whole team incurred a suspension because of those two positive tests. And it seemed legitimate to expect them to be struck off for at least a year, if not more. And for Nippo Fantini, who could boast Damiano Cunego, that they would get the invitation. Cunego, of course, won the 2004 Giro d'Italia, another rider who intended to ride his last Giro this year, and he was going to actually retire at the end of the Giro, and that will not happen. Now they got another very talented rider, Marco Canola, who was one of the best riders, I would say, of any or in any professional division team last year. So he's going to miss out as well. So a bit of a surprise. And also, there's not been a lot of sort of transparency. There's not been a lot of talk in the press about why that particular choice, Bardiani, were included. Maraveni, the Giro organiser, has not really said too much about it. Nippo Fantini themselves have sort of gone to ground. Last year, they made some very angry statements about their exclusion. I actually tried to call their team manager, Francesco Pelosi, today, but wasn't picking up. So there we go.
Yeah, it's a funny one. Willie are getting the nod over Vini Fantini. Does it come down to, is it their...
Bardiani.
Well... Willier. Yeah, Willier. I mean, does it come down to Cunego against Pozzato there? I mean, as the two sort of talisman of those teams.
It's funny, Willier were pretty much in the sort of weeks leading up to this announcement and decision were pretty much seen as a shoo-in. And why is that? Well, it's an Italian brand. Willier is the main sponsor. The secondary sponsor is Sell'Italia, another prominent Italian brand. And they're also... And partly thanks to Pozzato's very heavy presence on social media. They're also a team that boasts kind of good visibility, I think. RCS and the Giro are quite susceptible to that nowadays. You know, with these things, we talked about last week with the Tour de France, there's always a suspicion that there are other interests at play behind the scenes. And, you know, Nippo Fantini, for some reason, RCS and the Giro don't seem to particularly like them. I mean, this was the ideal opportunity to pick them. And I was talking to a colleague of ours, Herbie Sykes, the other day, and Herbie reminded me that in 2015, one of what was at that time the Nippo Fantini team, so one of the sort of the kind of forefathers of that team, one of their riders, Daniele Colli, had a bad fall on stage 6, I think, in 2015. He was hit by a spectator leaning over the barrier, and what ensued was quite an ugly dispute between RCS and the management of the team at that time, the management of what is now Nippo Fantini. I don't know if that's got anything to do with why they haven't got the wild card, but it could possibly be.
And one of the, possibly another team that could feel hard done by would be the Gazprom Rusvelo team, who've ridden for at least the last 2 years. A couple of years ago, Alexander Foliferov won the time trial at, where was that, Daniel? Alpe di Siusi, was it?
Correct.
That was a mountain time trial. Quite a stunning result at the time, that was, wasn't it? They didn't do anything last year, really, in the race. They were just kind of riding around in blue jerseys from what I saw.
Nice blue jerseys.
They were very nice blue jersey, yeah, but they'll probably feel slightly hard done by not to get an invite back. But it's the same with the Tour de France, isn't it? Only so many places available.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
So what was that, chaps? Well, I think we've been interrupted by Seb Piquet, familiar voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France. We're being assailed by sirens in all directions at the moment.
We are, but that particular siren is to let all of our listeners know that we have a message from our commercial partners and friends, Beer 52. And the offer to all listeners of the Cycling Podcast is free beer, exclusively to you listeners. I mean, who's not going to like that? As long as you are in the UK and aged 18 or over. The Cycling Podcast has secured an amazing offer for all of our listeners with our friends at Beer 52. You can get a case of 8 craft beers for free. You just have to pay for the delivery. That's correct. You'll receive 8 incredible craft beers, a copy of Ferment magazine, and a snack. and you just have to pay £5.95 to get them delivered to you. This is a kind of a beer club, but if the club is not for you, you're not obliged to sign up. You can leave any time and rejoin if you want. There's no catch to this offer at all. We actually got sent 8 of the beers, Rich, and the selection we had...
8 each, not 8 to share,
we
fortunately.
Did, indeed, yes. And the selection we had was 4 pairs of beers. The idea is that a couple of the beers are very similar to one another, so I was enjoying California Dreaming and Dreaming of Freaks, which are kind of an IPA type beer, and one ingredient is changed between the two beers, so you notice quite a different taste with only one ingredient change. Quite interesting. And you can read about the kind of the tasting notes and what you're supposed to be picking up in the magazine as well. So it really is a no-brainer if Belgian beers are your thing after a long ride, or if you want to watch the classics, order yourself some Beer 52 beers. But you can get a selection of 8 delivered to you, incredible craft beers to enjoy for free, and all while helping to support your favourite cycling show. So to claim this amazing offer, just go to beer52.com/cycling and claim your free case today with the code cycling at checkout.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast again in 2018. And a reminder that they've upped the discount for listeners to the Cycling Podcast to 25%. If you enter the code SISCP25 at the checkout, you'll get 25% off. I mentioned last week that we are asking for questions for some of their experts, including James Morton, who works for Team Sky, Rob Child, who has worked with Katusha, and other world-class experts on sports nutrition at Science and Sport. We'll be convening them at some point soon to put some of your questions to them. We've had a few already. Send us your nutrition questions. They can be personal questions. You might have an event coming up. You might be training for something. Or they can be questions about what the pros eat and drink and how they manage their nutrition. So send us your questions to contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, and we'll put those questions to the Science and Sport experts, and we'll play some of those answers throughout the year is the plan. So any questions at all, send them in. And before that, we heard from this week's episode sponsor Beer 52. About them, we've been enjoying our Beer 52. In this part of the podcast, we are going to be looking back at the Tour Down Under, the first big race of the year, first big road race of the year. I should clarify, it was won by Daryl Impey, who's 33 years old now, no spring chicken. He's been around a bit. He's a very up and down career, but in the last few years at Orica Scott and now Mitchelton Scott, he's really become a very solid rider. Obviously, yellow jersey wearer in the Tour de France a few years ago. He's been on Team Sky's radar for a couple of years. Dave Brailsford has really wanted to sign him. I'm not sure what happened there, but a very solid rider. Biggest win of his career, South African rider, of course.
Just on Sky, I think they were quite nervous, Rich. The reason Sky didn't follow through with the signing, more one reason anyway, was that he initially failed a test for probenecid, which was the substance which became infamous because of Pedro Delgado's positive test in the 1988 Tour de France, wasn't it? But then the UCI sort of accepted his explanation that it came from contaminated gel, I think. Not hair gel.
Well, contaminated gel capsules, I think, that they got from a pharmacy in South Africa.
I think Sky were a bit nervous about that whole thing and how it would look publicly if they did sign MP.
Yeah, and they wouldn't want anything that would, you know, cause controversy or any of that kind of
Absolutely
thing, would they? They'd steer well clear
not,
of all
not
that.
Not them.
Well, we discussed that at length last week, Lionel. I don't think we'll be returning it in too much detail this week, though. On Chris Froome quickly, and before we talk about the Tour Down Under, I gather Chris Froome will make his season debut at the Ruta del Sol in southern Spain. I will be there, actually. We'll both be making our season debuts at the Ruta del Sol. That's unconfirmed, but I have on pretty good authority that Froome is planning to race there. A lot of people surprised at the way that he appears to be, it appears to be business as usual. And, you know, certainly on social media and so on, Froome is putting up a very positive, no pun intended, front. I'm quite surprised, not surprised, but baffled a little bit by the demeanour that he's displaying on social media, because on the one hand, he's wanting to obviously send out a message that all is well and he's got nothing to worry about. But on the other hand, if you are in his position and you have this adverse analytical finding, which might turn into an anti-doping rule violation hanging over your head, you're not really going to be feeling like that, are you? So there's a inauthenticity to that, I think.
That's speculation, really, isn't it? We don't know Chris Froome's state of mind.
I'm just putting myself in his shoes and imagining how I would feel in that situation.
Again, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, if it turns out that he is banned from cycling because he takes asthma medicine and something went awry, which is the everything that they've set out, then he would presumably think, well, I've done nothing wrong. I mean, that's the stance that they... You know, I would say the sunny disposition on social media is consistent with that stance. And, yeah, I mean, I don't really know what to make of it. But certainly if, Rich, you say Froome is going to race at the Ruta del Sol, then the questions and the intensity of those questions is going to ramp right up. I mean, we've already seen several riders having their say about the Chris Froome situation and what they think. And that is only going to, from Team Sky and Froome's point of view, that is only going to get worse. It's not going to suddenly clear up until there is some kind of decision about this case. But we'll perhaps come back to that a little bit.
Yeah, just finally on that, I shared an email last week in the podcast from a listener, Arthur Cook, who speculated that Froome might be subjecting himself to a test last Friday. He thought he was replicating a Grand Tour in his training. It certainly looks from Strava that he has been doing that, but he didn't do a test last week. And he may well do the test at some point, try and replicate the conditions of the Vuelta and prove that something went wrong in his body with the storage and release of salbutamol. He may have to do that as part of the process to clear his name, but he hasn't done it as of yet. Back to Tour Down Under. I mentioned last week in the podcast that Richie Porte might be bluffing when talking down his chances on Willunga Hill, that he might work for Rowan Dennis. Rowan Dennis was nowhere really. Richie Porte, as you said earlier in the news roundup, Lionel, Richie Porte won for a fifth consecutive time and looks like he has fully recovered from his crashes at the Tour de France last year. He'll be wanting to maybe pace himself a little bit better this season because he was really on fire in the early part of the year last year. And obviously had that very unfortunate crash at the Tour. Don't know how they've got on there. But, you know, given all that's going on in the world of cycling, given the uncertainty over Chris Froome, there could be a real chance for somebody like Richie Porte this year. I mean, we're talking more about him here than about Daryl Impey. Impey rode extremely well to win the race, but I think Richie Porte's performance was the one that really caught the eye.
Well, it did, because he's been out of action for so long, and you're never quite sure. I mean, his recovery was remarkably quick, really, wasn't it? The speed with which he was kind of up and about and then back on his bike. But you're never quite sure until people get back into the heat of battle, so to speak, how they will respond. Richie Porte is kind of back where he's been. I mean, you know, fifth year in a row on that hill. I would have to just temper that without straying into my usual criticism of the Tour Down Under as a pre-season friendly, but we have to weigh up the performance against bear in mind the time of year and weigh up the level of the opposition. I mean, Daryl Impey is a whatever the Australian for super domestique is, Bonza helper mate, probably something like that. I know he's South African, but he rides for an Aussie team.
He's the most Bonza helper this side of the rabbit proof fence, mate.
Oh dear, I can
this side of the black stump, mate. Do you not know that?
I can feel the whole of Australia turning off the cycling podcast. I'm sorry about that.
I had a period in my teens where I was obsessed with Australian English strine. So I've got all those expressions are just ready to unleash. Anyway, go on.
But, you know, it's a funny mix of people, isn't it? Tom Hjelte-Slagter was third on Willunga Hill.
Well, I was going to mention him. He's third overall as well. And he's had a few really... He won the Tour Down Under before, of course, before moving to Garmin as a sort of really hot prospect. Has had a really poor years there. Moved to Dimension Data, and that's a really good performance. I mean, Dimension Data, I think, will be extremely happy because they certainly need a few more performances of that in World Tour races.
Yeah, and then after that, you know, Dries De Venins, who we assume will be sort of strong in the spring for Quickstep. And then the other eye-catching performance was Team Sky's first-year professional making his World Tour, well, certainly his Sky debut in a World Tour race. I think he rode the Tour of Lombardy last year,
didn't he?
So it wasn't... That wasn't actually his debut in a World Tour race, but you know, first big stage race where Team Sky actually stated before the race that he would be the leader. This is the Colombian Egan Bernal, and he really does look like the real deal. We always sort of, well, I always kind of worry when young riders are hyped up, but when you look at the results that he's had as a as an under 23, and when you consider that he is born in January 1997, so he's still only 21, and only just 21 at that. Yeah, I mean, he could well be, you know, with talking about Chris Froome, give it a couple of years and Team Sky may not need to worry about who the leader is, because Bernal might be the sort of rider who could just come in and just wrestle that away.
Okay, here's a really speculative question. You'll hate it, Lionel. Say, let's imagine Chris Froome is unavailable for selection at the Tour de France. Who would lead Team Sky?
Wout Poels.
Wout Poels? Michał Kwiatkowski?
Yeah. Possibly.
What do you think, Daniel?
I think Poels would be a risk. He still never finished on the podium of a Grand Tour, has he? His best performances have always been in support of other riders. In fact, I don't think he hasn't finished in the top five of a Grand Tour, sixth at the Vuelta last year. And, you know, we've talked before about, particularly in relation to Team Sky, how there's often been this misapprehension that a super domestique who seems to be accompanying the leader, whether it be Wiggins or Froome in the mountains, is then capable of stepping up and you know, riding equally well as a team leader, and that's not been the case. I mean, yeah, we've seen that with Richie Porte. Richie Porte has still yet to register a podium finish in the Tour de France, or a Grand Tour, in fact. They would have a few options. You know, they could even try someone like Kwiatkowski out, although I don't think he was necessarily consistent enough in last year's Tour de France to suggest that that would be a wise decision. Geraint Thomas as well has been fallible at times in Grand Tour. So I don't think there's an obvious candidate, or I don't see one guy without Landa.
Sorry, I should just clarify. I wasn't trying to win the race. I was just he was going to be the leader. Going for stage wins.
Rich, just going back to Port, having mentioned Port there, you know, I never really had any worries that he was going to recover physically, but I think the big issue for him is going to be the mental scars that crash in the Tour de France has left. I mean, even in interviews over the past few months since that crash in the Tour de France, people who were around him at the time, Dan Martin, Christian, a couple of them have hinted that they thought Port was already nervous on that particular descent. And I think we talked, and a lot of other people talked before the Tour de France last year, about, you know, whether Port was, whether he was going to choke, but, you know, whether he was, his nerves were ultimately going to get the better of him, because his form had been so good in the run-up to the Tour de France. And if he was already nervous last year before that happened, then it'll be even harder, I think, to overcome sort of whatever demons or insecurities he might have about going into that race to try and win it. I mean, I hope for his sake that he does overcome whatever legacy it's left, but that's not going to be easy, I don't think. I don't know if you listen to the controversial Lance Armstrong's podcast.
Sometimes, yeah, I have done. Not recently, though.
He did a good one fairly recently with Bode Miller, the American downhill skier, and they talked a lot there in that about fear, and about obviously the fear that downhill skiers face whenever they compete. But also Armstrong talked about the fear that he felt on every long descent in a race like the Tour de France. And that's something that I think we very often overlook. We think that it's a perfectly routine part of bike racing for most of the guys in the peloton, but that I think for a large proportion of them, a large proportion of the descents they do are very frightening experiences.
That was one I saw that did catch my eye or ear, actually, the Bode Miller one. He's a fascinating character. But on the subject of Lance Armstrong, that brings us neatly to somebody else who was at the Tour Down Under, David LaPartion, the new UCI president. And, you know, now he's attending races like that. He's obviously making public statements and some quite punchy stuff from him in terms of Armstrong and his invitation to the Tour of Flanders about Team Sky and whether or not they should suspend Chris Froome while his case remains unresolved. I mean, in both cases, you could argue that he's just speaking common sense in a lot of ways.
Playing to the crowd, isn't he? He's playing to the gallery with these comments, though. I mean, the one about Lance Armstrong, I mean, you know, Lance Armstrong doped all the way through his career, brought the sport into disrepute, quite rightly banned. We could debate whether or not he deserved a life ban or not, given the severity of his doping against others. That's, you know, that's a different debate. But the bottom line is he is banned from the sport for life as it stands at the moment, until whether he chooses to challenge that at some point, who knows. And there's a line, you know. He tried to do his podcast from an event in America, didn't he, which was UCI sanctioned last year, and he was prevented from doing so they kind of did it from outside the ropes instead. And he's been invited to speak at this event, or just attend this event in the weekend of the Tour of Flanders, and you know, it's a case of whether or not that is an accredited UCI event or not, and it clearly isn't, and he's entitled to go. And the organisers, whether we like that decision or not, whether we think that Lance Armstrong is a disgrace to cycling or not, in that case, he is entitled to be invited.
It's not an official. It's an official Tour of Flanders event, though, and he is banned from UCI. The ban is from racing and all activities associated with racing. Would that not fall under?
Well, it's not. I checked this, Rich. It's not actually the same organizer. It's
all right. Okay.
Well, it's a different company that's organizing it. I think it's called the Tour of Flanders Academy, isn't it? So
it's splitting hairs, and it's a technicality, and they probably set it up in that way to kind of get round it. And the association with the Tour of Flanders is obvious and apparent to anyone, and people won't draw the distinction between which is the company behind this and that. But at the end of the day, unfortunately, whether we like it or not, there's nothing to actually prevent him circumnavigating that rule in order to go and attend that event. And I think La Passion, as a politician, as somebody who is a spokesman for the sport, needs to kind of grow up a bit in that respect and acknowledge what the rules are. And I think, coming on to the Chris Froome thing, I completely agree with him that it is bad for cycling that this is going to carry on hanging over all events until it's resolved. It's going to worsen. It's not going to get better. My own personal views are that I think Team Sky should have taken him out of competition and said that that's what they were doing, but they haven't done that, and they are perfectly entitled to do so according to the results and according to the rules. And I think for La Passion to kind of, it's a kind of a populist statement to make. It sounds strong. It sounds like the sort of thing that cycling's been crying out for, but actually, on any kind of inspection, it's not a very smart thing to have said. But it does get column inches, it does get coverage, it does get him talked about. But I think the UCI president role really ought to be a bit above that. And I mean, whether or not we think Brian Cookson was impressive as UCI president or not, I think that would be debatable. I think Pat McQuaid, said and did some things that you could say didn't help professional cycling. And I don't think that La Passion really has set off in... he might have set off in a slightly different direction, but I don't think he's really established himself as a kind of statesman-like figure on kind of day one at work.
Tend to agree with you, Lionel, but there's a bit of a continuum here, isn't there, with sort of Hein Verbruggen at one end and then Brian Cookson at the other end. We got a bit frustrated. I mean, I got a bit frustrated quite early on with hearing Brian Cookson say we have to respect the due process and not taking a position on things. And yet, at the other end of the scale, you had someone like Hein Verbruggen who didn't really seem to care about the rules. He didn't really seem to care about his own personality, his own ego, and it was kind of off with their heads sort of mentality. And he often seems to be ruling on a whim and according to how sort of the mood took him at that time, but at least you sort of knew where you stood. I mean, on La Passion, the strange thing is that he seems to be almost criticising his own organisation's rules, in the sense that he's saying Chris Froome should be suspended by Team Sky provisionally. Well, you know, if you look, and I did go this week and read the UCI regulations on provisional suspensions, they are perfectly within their rights. The UCI would be to provisionally suspend him, and it doesn't, you know, there's nothing in the rules which sets out exactly under which circumstances they should or shouldn't do that. So there's quite a lot of latitude for them. You know, if they, for example, think, and they seem to think, that it's bad for the sport, this ambiguity that's reigning at the moment, they could do it. There's nothing in the rules that says they can't. There's nothing in the WADA code that says they can't. The issue is that would look, well, it would look bad, set against precedents where they haven't done that in the past. And also, you know, people would perhaps accuse them of giving Froome, well, particularly harsh treatment because he's a figurehead of the sport.
Yeah, I think finally on La Passion, I mean, judge him on actions rather than statements. I mean, if he set out to try and change some of these rules and regulations which are within UCI's jurisdiction and ones that wouldn't conflict with the wider code, then fair play. If that's how he wanted to set out his presidency and go for it, and he could get a kind of a, you know, groundswell of support behind it, I'd be all for that. But just kind of, you know, talk is pretty cheap when you're the president of a governing body, I think. And I agree with you, Daniel. You know, Cookson was one extreme, Verbruggen with another, but Le Passion kind of promised us a sort of third way, didn't he? That was the ticket he came in on, and so far I would say sort of C-, really. Not that it matters what I think.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you to our main sponsor, Rafa, for sponsoring the cycling podcast once again in 2018. Very grateful to them indeed. Our Rafa clothing, our Pedalar de Charme clothing, is available on the Rafa website. You can reach our page by clicking on shop at thecyclingpodcast.com. We should also mention our Friends program for 2018. Thanks to everybody who's already signed up. We've released 3 episodes so far, more to come soon. Become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. It costs £15 for the year, and you'll get lots of exclusive episodes and treats from behind our paywall. More to come on that very soon. In this final part of our second podcast of 2018, we were going to just pick out a couple of things that we're looking forward to in 2018, because we didn't really have time to do that last week. What are you looking forward to, Lionel, if that's not a strange question to be putting to such a famous curmudgeon?
Are you saying I don't really
the
look forward to
anything? The misanthropic Lionel Burney. What are you most looking forward to this year? What are you least not looking forward to?
Well, what I'm least not looking forward to, for me, I'm going to struggle to look ahead to the Giro, the Tour and the Vuelta, partly because the landscape of the Grand Tours is so uncertain with the Chris Froome story yet to resolve itself. So for me, certainly the first part of the year is all about the classics, and the Flanders classics in particular. There's been quite a bit of rejigging of some of the races this spring. The Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, Richard, which you're going to at the end of February, has got a new finish which really harks back to the old Tour of Flanders finish. It's going to finish in Meerbeke, which is where the Tour of Flanders used to finish until a few years ago when that moved to Oudenaarde. So, and they're going to run over the Mur in Gerardsbergen and the Bosberg, and that is a very well-known sort of last 16 kilometres, the approach into Gerardsbergen, down the big hill, up through the town, onto the kind of the gentle cobbles, and then round onto the citadel. I'm not actually sure whether they're going to do that, the famous Kappelmoor bit, or whether they're going to go up the kind of the more main road when they come across the square there. You can go past the turning for the Kappelmoor and then go up a main road, which is still steep, but not as iconic. But then the Bosberg, which again doesn't look much. It's only sort of 300 metres long, but often can be the thing that decides. It used to be a kind of a springboard for riders in the bit that could really crack people on the run in, and then it is quite a long way from the Bosberg to the finish, so you get that kind of quite suspense filled run in to the finish there, because I think it's still another 8, 9, 10, possibly even more kilometres to the finish there. Dwarsdorf-Landeren, which is a little bit later on, is also changing. It's moving to the Wednesday before the Tour of Flanders. So the character of the race is going to be completely changed. It's only going to be 180 kilometres long rather than sort of 200 and a bit. And all of the cobblestone climbs are being taken out, so it'll only be smooth climbs. So the Nochteberg, or the Côte de Trux, as they call it in French, will probably be the most important part of the finale. And then there's the Skelderpleis, which is the race that sprinters often do well in. And that used to start in Antwerp. Well, now it's moving to a coastal town in the Netherlands, and it's going to go through Zeeland. They're hoping for echelons and that kind of thing, so to break it up and change the character of the race a little bit. Skelderpreis, of course, Mark Cavendish has won in the past, Marcel Kittel. So I'm looking forward to seeing how all of those little and some not so little changes affect the character of those races. I suspect, as I wrote in our book, you know, the character of these races, they all have something in common, and yet they're all slightly different. And it's quite interesting to see the Flanders Classics organisation just tweaking things, keeping the Tour of Flanders the same as it's been in the last few years, but just sort of fiddling around the edges just to see what that brings.
Daniel, what are you looking forward to?
Wow, lots of things, Rich. But we're talking about cycling, right? Cycling, just, well,
whatever you fancy talking about.
No. Where are the British Speed Golf Championships this year, Daniel?
Well, I was about to say that's going to be announced in the next couple of weeks. I'm actually thinking of entering the US Open. It's in Houston in December. Anyway, cycling. San Remo, I always look forward to. Always my famous, my favourite race of the year. Most people think it's boring. I think it's fantastic. I actually came across, can I read a fantastic quote that I came across from Mario Cipollini earlier today? A completely bizarre, impenetrable, indecipherable quote. See if you can make any sense of this. This is Mario Cipollini, 2002 winner of Milan San Remo, about that particular race. Once upon a time, cycling was a Michelin-starred restaurant. You could go there and eat a simple course of spaghetti carbonara, but that course was San Remo. It had an incredible flavour. Today, we're always eating spaghetti carbonara, but we're not stopping at a Michelin-starred restaurant to eat it. We're just stopping in the service station. What on earth is he talking about?
I have no idea.
Any ideas? That was the equivalent of sardines and trawlers and Cantona.
I just heard spaghetti carbonara multiple times, and now all I want is a spaghetti carbonara.
That was pretty much apropos of nothing, vaguely linked to San Remo. But yeah, I'm interested to see if Sagan can finally win there. I think I said last year that he needs to be prepared to lose that race before, he needs to go in sort of ready to, well, I think he needs to go in really content to play his card in a sprint finish and not to waste energy.
He's been really good at losing it in the past.
Yeah, sort of silly vanity of attacks on the Poggio, which, you know, are entertaining, but have not really helped his chances of winning at all. So looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to seeing how Dan Martin gets on at UAE. I'm really intrigued by that because I think it's a real challenge for him. I think he's a very mature rider. He's an independent rider. He knows how to sort of manage himself and his career. However, that is a tough team to go into, I think, when you've been at Cannondale, Garmin, and then Quickstep, because it's essentially the old Lampre team. It's a completely Italian team. All the staff's Italian, and I would suggest maybe a little bit old-fashioned. So I think that's going to be challenging. And also, they've got Fabio Aru now, who I think is really going to... He's almost sort of taking over that team, just looking at the way the team's communicating through the media, and he's very much the figurehead of the UAE team, not Dan Martin. So it's going to be interesting. Third thing, Rich, Quickstep themselves, they've got three sort of swashbuckling young leaders, Alaphilippe, Gaviria and Jungels, and they're all guys with a lot of charisma, a lot of charm, got a lot about them. But, you know, the last few years I've become more and more conscious of, you know, the sort of gift and the curse that can be for young riders nowadays, particularly with things like social media and so forth. And you know, for guys who you know, quite attractive.
Daniel,
to
I'm not being funny.
Sorry.
Did I not say on the phone yesterday this was going to be my thing?
Oh, sorry. Well, we can both say the same thing, but we can come up with original and, you know, different twists on the same question. Anyway, no, you know, these guys, they're a marketeer's dream ticket, all three of them, but you know, that carries its own perils, doesn't it? And, you know, I've been talking to a few riders over the last few months who have talked about how cycling's getting harder and harder. I was speaking to Matt Brammeyer recently, the Aqua Blue rider, and he was telling me that he thinks riders' careers are going to get shorter and shorter because you have to train so hard now. Everyone's on it all year from January until November, pretty much. And you simply can't be going out or neglecting your training or living the playboy lifestyle. I'm not suggesting Bob Jungels, Gaviria or Alaphilippe does live a playboy lifestyle, but they could do, you know, they've got that in their locker if they wanted to, is what I'm saying, Rich.
Fantastic stuff. Already only our second race of the season for the Cycling Podcast, and Daniel has done the equivalent of attack his own teammate.
He's blamed me.
Pinching the thing he's looking forward to this season.
I should also point out. I had a phone call with Daniel yesterday, and he's just gone off and he's just run with it, hasn't he? He's taken the ball and he has just run with it into the corner.
It's a bit like saying, oh, I'm going to attack on the Galibier, and then somebody getting in before him.
I should also have pointed out that the previous point about Alaphilippe in particular was based on an eyewitness account of a dance-off. In which he was one of the competitors. I'm not going to say who the other one was.
I thought of that sort of insight, but year. Quickstep, I am looking forward to seeing how Quickstep get on for all the reasons you've just mentioned, Daniel. But, you know, I think that team has often had too many chiefs. You know, we've seen it in races where tactics and so on have been confused because they've had too many strong riders. There have been occasions also where it's worked to their advantage, such as the year that Nicky Terpstra won Paris-Roubaix, for example. But I think they're very streamlined looking this year. They've lost a couple of strong riders. Julien Vermot has gone to Dimension Data, and Mathieu Trentin. They will be missed. But those three young riders in particular are probably three of the most exciting young riders in the sport, and they're all just on the verge, I think, of a major breakthrough. I mean, Jungels and Alaphilippe are both 25, Gaviria's 23. Gaviria is already capable of winning top races. I think he'll win stages at the Tour de France. Bob Jungels going to the Tour as well. I'm not sure what he will do there, but maybe a solid top 10 for him. He's still maturing as a GC rider. But the three of them are, you know, given their head, as they will be at Quickstep this year, without, you know, some older riders getting in the way, I think it's very, very exciting for that team and interesting, because the team has been around for so long and it's really been remolded, refashioned this year. They've got Enric Mas as well, the Spanish rider who is very promising. Philippe Gilbert is their kind of experienced head now and is going to try and win Milan-San Remo and Paris-Roubaix. That's his. Those are his targets this year. So very, very interesting year. And already, you know, they've got a win on the board, haven't they? Thanks to Elia Viviani at the Tour Down Under.
Rich, if I may stick my oar in one last time, this is probably should have been my answer, so as not to step on your toes. And also Movistar, I was very intrigued. I've been very intrigued the last couple of weeks to note that of their three leaders, so a lot's been made of the fact they've got three leaders this year: Nairo Quintana, Mikel Landa, and Alejandro Valverde. None of them seems to want to do the Giro, or seems to want to target the Giro. So, it on paper, it's going to get very crowded for them at the Tour de France and the Vuelta. And knowing Landa as we do, you know, he's a bit of a—I'm not going to say loose cannon, but he's a bit of a free spirit, shall we say? Then could see fireworks.
Indeed. David Godu as well, the young French rider at Francis de Jeu, really caught the eye last year in a couple of races, Flèche Wallonne, and was it the Tour of Catalunya in particular? He looks very good, and I expect to see him develop again this year. I must say as well, just a little nod towards the Cycling Podcast Femina, where we cover women's racing, of course, but I think the women's scene is going to be very interesting this year because there's been a lot of movement among the top teams. Bulls Domas have been very dominant for a few years, but there looks to be a much better balance there in terms of some of the other teams. Canyon SRAM, Wiggle, High Five have made some good signings. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see sort of familiar riders in new kit. It could alter the dynamics quite a lot in women's racing, make it a bit more equal. And I'm looking forward to seeing what transpires there.
Yeah, just on dynamics and back to the Men's World Tour, obviously the team sizes are changing. It's only on paper, it looks like an insignificant-ish change. It's something that a lot of people clamoured for, cutting the team sizes from 9 to 8 at the Grand Tours and from 8 to 7 at pretty much everything else. Still some races where there are smaller teams, but you know, the classics with 7 riders instead of 8, and the week-long stage races also 7 riders. We'll see somebody do something slightly different, either in terms of team selection or in terms of the way that they ride a race. And Rich, when you were talking about Quickstep there, you know, they've often had, well, in the Tour de France, of course, they had Kittel and Dan Martin last year, and they were able to support both of those riders pretty well, but not perhaps 100% well when it really mattered. But teams might have to pick and choose a little bit and maybe just go with one objective in some of the bigger races. It will be interesting to see how they approach it.
Mitchelton Scott are going to the Tour, we already know, with a sprinter and a GC rider, Adam Yates and Caleb Ewan. So that's maybe a surprise, but I don't think it's going to make a lot of difference. I think if it went down to seven or six riders, then we'd be talking about it making a real difference. I think going down to eight riders is I don't think it's going to make any difference at all.
Chaps, answer this question for me. In light of the sort of controversy and the people getting upset about not getting wild cards, given that each team is going to lose one rider at the Grand Tours, I know that one of the reasons to do that was to reduce the size of the peloton and make it safer overall, but could they not? There would have been room for one more team, wouldn't there? One more wild card in each major tour?
Well, I think the problem there would be the argument that's been made is that it's for safety issues, isn't it? As much as for to make the racing a bit more open and a bit less controlled by Team Sky, the safety argument has probably influence that, do you not think? Because losing,
or is that a Trojan horse? Is that a bit of
I think well you know, I think it a bit is, of a yeah facade? I mean, I spoke to Matt White about this recently, and he thinks it he said the safety argument is garbage, mate. He said that's terrible Australian accent, I apologize for that. I should have got Lionel to do that or Daniel, but
Lionel,
yeah, but yeah. I mean, I think the safety argument is nonsense, because it's not about the number of riders, it's about the number of riders trying to be at the front, and that there's still going to be the same number of riders trying to be at the front because there's the same number of sprinters, same number of leaders. So I don't think it's going to make an awful lot of difference. Safety, the safety is not compromised by the 20 or 30 extra riders at the back, is it? Do we have anything else to say this week?
No, I mean, we're going to miss the time cut again, aren't
we? Are we done?
You're not careful.
Okay, let's just knock it on the head there, shall we?
Did we get any questions? We asked for questions last week, didn't we? Did we get any questions?
Did we ask for questions?
Well, what I said, people could ask anything they want.
Yeah, we want sports nutrition questions, please, Lionel. Daniel, keep on message. Thank you very much.
And any other questions?
No one has taken us up on that invitation. Exactly, yeah.
We've got a few questions, but we're saving them up. Send us a question. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Should we wrap up there, fellas?
Yes, let's. There's a long, long, long way to go this season. We don't want to peak too early, do we?
No. Okay, well, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and YouTube to keep up with all the latest news and special offers from us. Just search online for The Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by John Mooney.